Chapter 17. Presidential Patronage and the Development of American Literature. It is not so much in buying pictures as in being pictures that you can encourage a noble school. John Ruskin, Lectures on Architecture and Painting. Great literary excitement swept across the country after the Revolutionary War. Though early American writers had expressed themselves in many ways throughout the colonial period, the birth of a new nation gave a new impetus to the literary culture. Authors grew anxious to create literature commensurate with the greatness of the United States, its ideals, values, landscape, and people. From the end of the war through his presidency, George Washington bore witness to the development of American literature. But he did more than watch it flourish. He actively encouraged authors to pursue their craft. Washington touched the lives of numerous writers during the final third of the 18th century. As president, he created an intellectual climate that fostered the development of American literature. Few authors exemplified the new literary climate under Washington's leadership more than Jeremy Belknap, whose life as a writer presents a good way to structure the story of Washington's literary patronage before, during, and after his presidency. Born in Boston, Belknap attended Harvard, ultimately earning his master's degree. After college, he became a congregational minister in Dover, New Hampshire, where he remained throughout the Revolutionary War. While there, he began writing a history of the state, the completion of which, war, career, family, and a profound determination to base his historical work on original sources, delayed for many years. In 1784, Belknap finished the first volume of The History of New Hampshire and arranged for Robert Aitken to publish it in Philadelphia. Since Belknap could not oversee publication himself, he asked his good friend and fellow historian Ebenezer Hazard to shepherd the work through the press. As its publication approached, Belknap wrote Hazard to see what he thought about sending a copy of the first volume of The History of New Hampshire to George Washington. Hazard responded enthusiastically, "I think it will be quite polite to present General Washington with a copy of your history, and it will produce a letter from him in his own handwriting, which will be worth preserving. I have several which I intend to hand down carefully to posterity as highly valuable." Belknap's desire to present a copy of his book to Washington seems altruistic. He apparently wished to give the former commander-in-chief the book as a token of respect for what he had accomplished during the war and what he meant to the nation. Hazard, on the other hand, seems quite mercenary. By presenting a book to General Washington, an author could receive in exchange a handwritten thank-you letter from the most famous man in America. Hazard's response raises the question, how many other authors sent Washington copies of their books primarily to receive autographed thank-you letters from him in return? Giving Hazard the okay, Belknap told him to present a copy of the first volume of The History of New Hampshire to Washington. Belknap also wrote a cover letter to accompany the book, explaining to Washington that the history related the early struggles and sufferings of one of those states which now claim the honor of being defended by your sword. New Hampshire, he continued, has bred a hardy race of men whose merits as soldiers are well known to their beloved general, and who will always glory in having assisted to plant the laurel which adorns his brow. Hazard had Robert Aitken handsomely bind the volume. Arguably the finest bookbinder in the nation, Aitken outdid himself this time, creating a sumptuous binding to touch the heart of any true bibliophile. Washington did not receive the book with Belknap's cover letter until the end of 1784, but, as Hazard predicted, he responded with a letter of thanks. Though brief, Washington's message seemed sincere. He appreciated Belknap's letter and the book it introduced. "For both, I pray you to accept my thanks, but my acknowledgments are more particularly due for your favorable impression in the former of my past endeavors to support the cause of liberty. The thank you letter seemed odd to Belknap. It sounded like Washington enjoyed the cover letter more than the 300-page history that had taken Belknap a dozen years to write. Still, Belknap told Hazard he would keep the letter and rank it among my valuables. Washington's letter proved to be more than a keepsake. Belknap sometimes had difficulty motivating himself to write, but Washington's thank you letter encouraged him to continue his literary efforts. This presentation copy of The History of New Hampshire made a handsome addition to Washington's library at Mount Vernon, which was expanding rapidly during the mid to late 1780s. Gradually, the collection was becoming just what he wanted, a library filled with informative works he could read for knowledge and pleasure. The Mount Vernon Library symbolized the idyllic world Washington had often dreamt of when he was at war. Before the decade ended, however, his devotion to the United States would override his personal concerns, and he would part from his home to lead the United States, putting it on a solid foundation for the future. On February 4, 1789, presidential electors from those states that had ratified the Constitution met to vote for president and vice president. The first federal Congress, scheduled to convene in New York on March 4th, would count the votes. Since Congress failed to achieve a quorum in March, the electoral votes would not be counted until the first week of April. Before the votes were counted, rumors of Washington's election to the presidency circulated throughout the nation, and he reluctantly made plans to leave Mount Vernon for New York. On April 1st, he conveyed his feelings in a letter to his good friend Henry Knox. The letter's congenial tone testifies to their friendship. Aware of Knox's literary bent, Washington took pains to make his letter entertaining. He observed that the extra month Congress required to count the electoral votes seemed like a reprieve to him. Developing his comparison to a condemned man, he told Knox, "My movements to the chair of government will be accompanied with feelings not unlike those of a culprit who is going to the place of his execution. So unwilling am I, in the evening of a life nearly consumed in public cares, to quit a peaceful abode for an ocean of difficulties without that competency of political skill, abilities and inclination which is necessary to manage the helm." Switching from simile to metaphor before this sentence ends, Washington evoked the ship of state theme, a figurative comparison that would appeal to numerous presidents after him. Regardless of which figures of speech he used, his letter to Knox embodies the self-effacing modesty Washington expressed in many of his statements concerning his role as a leader. The day after counting the votes that officially elected George Washington president and John Adams vice president, Congress dispatched its secretary, Charles Thompson, to Mount Vernon. Having faithfully served as secretary to the Continental Congress and the Confederation Congress, Thompson fulfilled his new responsibility with diligence. Leaving New York on Tuesday, April 7th, he endured bad roads, blustery weather, and rivers that overflowed their banks on his way from New York to Mount Vernon. After crossing the Potomac, he reached Washington's home the following Tuesday, when he informed him of his election to the office of the President of the United States of America. Since Washington had already heard rumors of his election, Thompson's arrival did not surprise him. By the time Thompson reached Mount Vernon, Washington was packed and almost ready to leave for New York. On April 16th, about 10 o'clock in the morning, Washington, Thomas, David Humphreys, and Billy Lee left together. Washington wrote a melancholy note in his diary. "I bade adieu to Mount Vernon, to private life, and to domestic felicity." They were greeted with pomp and pageantry throughout the journey. Billy, whose health had deteriorated in recent years, was forced to stay in Philadelphia for medical treatment as the others continued to New York. Overall, they made good time on their northward trek, taking one day less from Mount Vernon to New York than it had taken Thompson to make the opposite journey. On April 30, 1789, George Washington took the oath of office at Federal Hall. There was no inaugural ball. That tradition would not start until James Madison became president, largely at the instigation of his wife, Dolly. After his inauguration, President Washington simply got down to business. Having proven himself in his capacity as Washington's personal secretary at Mount Vernon, Tobias Lear agreed to serve as presidential secretary and became the president's closest associate. Washington entrusted him with affairs of state. Lear carried out his responsibilities with diligence and dedication. In Washington's first year as president, Lear married Polly Long. When she gave birth to their first son, Benjamin, in 1791, the president became the boy's godfather. Washington grew fond of the little tyke, calling him our little favorite. Washington was self-conscious about his behavior in office. He knew that everything he did would set a precedent for future presidents. Though the Constitution established the basic framework for the American government, the president and the legislators still had to flesh out the administration. This year, Congress created three executive departments: State, War, and Treasury. It was up to Washington to choose the men who would head each. He selected Alexander Hamilton for Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Knox as Secretary of War, and Thomas Jefferson as Secretary of State. Within the first few years of his administration, President Washington began meeting regularly with these department heads, who collectively became known as the President's Cabinet. Congress passed the Judiciary Act in September, creating the federal court system and the Office of Attorney General. By the end of the month, Washington had selected John Jay to serve as Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court and Edmund Randolph as Attorney General. Even for someone who was as keen a judge of character as Washington, all this selecting and appointing was hard work. He would soon choose all the associate justices of the Supreme Court. Congress adjourned on September 29, 1789. Washington kept working. His diary entry for Monday, October 5th, provides a good indication of Washington's daily activities as the main business of establishing the government drew to a close that year. He dispatched commissions to the Supreme Court justices and the judges of the district courts. He also sent copies of the acts respecting the Department of Justice to others involved, marshals and attorneys and such. Between 9 and 11 in the morning, he exercised on horseback. He exercised a second time, taking a walk between 5 and 6 in the afternoon. Walking and riding helped clear his head and enabled him to concentrate on official business with greater intensity. At some point that day, Washington enjoyed a conversation with his Treasury Secretary, who was quickly becoming his most trusted advisor. He asked Hamilton about the possibility of taking a tour of the New England states while Congress was in recess. Washington wanted to know the region a little better, to observe its products and its people, to get a feel for their attitude toward the federal government. Hamilton loved the idea and encouraged him to go. Washington began planning the journey. The diary does not list everything the president did on October 5, 1789. An additional document that has recently come to light reveals another activity. The ledgers of the New York Society Library show that Washington borrowed two books that Monday. Perhaps he stopped by the library on his morning horseback ride. Founded in 1754 and patterned on the Library Company of Philadelphia, the mother of all the North American subscription libraries, in Benjamin Franklin's words, the New York Society Library was a subscription library, meaning that members bought shares, which entitled them to borrow books from the collection and to help decide which books the library acquired. Usually members were the only ones who could borrow books from a subscription library. Understandably, the New York Society Library extended borrowing privileges to President Washington, and he was happy to patronize the place. The library's holdings were quite similar to those of other contemporary subscription libraries. The collection contained biographies, histories, voyages, and works by many respected English authors, including Daniel Defoe and Alexander Pope. In other words, it contained the same kinds of books that Washington enjoyed. Though he apparently hoped he might do a little reading before he left on his New England tour, Washington would not divert himself with belles lettres during his few spare moments as president. Instead, he borrowed books that would help direct the policies of the new nation: Emmerich de Vattel's Law of Nations and the 12th volume of The Parliamentary Register, or History of the Proceedings and Debates of the House of Commons. Law of Nations is a seminal work in the development of American foreign policy. Few subjects were more appropriate for Washington to read in his role as president than the Law of Nations. Philadelphia printer Thomas Bradford said as much in the edition of G. F. DeMartin's Summary of the Law of Nations he issued in 1795, which he dedicated to Washington. A Swiss diplomat and legal scholar, Vattel argued that since the European balance of power benefited all nations, it must be defended at all costs. No single state should be allowed to dominate Europe. If one nation threatened to create an empire, the others should band together to prevent it. Vattel's ideas shaped Alexander Hamilton's attitude toward national security and foreign policy. The following year, Hamilton emphasized the importance of Vattel, whom he called the most accurate and approved of the writers on the laws of nations. Hamilton concluded that Vattel's argument also applied to America. The national security of the United States, he believed, would depend on preserving the European balance of power. During Washington's administration, Vattel's Law of Nations would significantly shape U.S. foreign policy. Washington's Neutrality Proclamation, which declared that the United States was neutral in the conflict between Great Britain and France, reflects ideas consistent with Vattel's theory. Whereas Vattel's work provided key concepts affecting national foreign policy, the Parliamentary Register gave American readers, especially those active with the establishment of the new government, an opportunity to see how another nation's legislature worked. Since the 12th volume recorded legislative debates from 1779, it let Washington review what had happened in Parliament in a crucial year during the Revolutionary War. One section presents the debate over a motion for an inquiry into the conduct of the American War. Another records the debate over a motion that Lord Howe was not being properly supported or reinforced in America. Reading the 12th volume of the Parliamentary Register, Washington could have learned what had been happening in Parliament as he had confronted British troops on the battlefield. He obviously hoped to read both volumes he withdrew from the library, but he may not have had time to get through either. Though its borrowing ledgers indicate that the president checked the books out on October 5th, nowhere do they show him returning them. When the borrowing ledgers recently resurfaced, they created a minor sensation by revealing that President Washington never returned these overdue library books. In mid-October, Washington left New York for his tour of New England. The journey brought him through Connecticut, Massachusetts, and New Hampshire. He observed the progress of agriculture across the region and witnessed the start of some of the earliest factories in the United States. Everywhere he was honored and feted, and he had the opportunity to meet many of New England's leading citizens. In Boston, for example, he received the city's clergymen, a group that included the Reverend Jeremy Belknap. Since publishing the first volume of his History of New Hampshire, Belknap had grown dissatisfied with his position in Dover. He resigned from his pulpit in 1786 and accepted a new position with Long Lane Church in Boston the following year. The position brought him back to his birthplace and closer to much of the primary research materials necessary for his historical research. Though he could not talk with Washington very long, Belknap did speak with him long enough to remind the president of the ongoing New Hampshire History Project and receive a message of encouragement. Recording the experience in the pages of his almanac, Belknap captured the words he received from the president. "I am indebted to you, sir, for the history of New Hampshire," Washington told him. "It gave me great pleasure." The president's acknowledgement encouraged Belknap to keep writing. Quoting the manuscript note from his almanac, Belknap's biographer commented, "This is the only instance that appears of his recording the approbation of others, and it shows how highly he valued these few and simple words of courtesy from the father of his country." Leaving Boston the last week of October, Washington crossed the Charles River and proceeded to Cambridge, a place that held special significance as his first command post during the Revolutionary War. Harvard President Joseph Willard took him on a tour of the campus library. Then, the greatest collection of books in the nation, the Harvard Library contained 13,000 volumes, as Washington noted in his diary. Theological literature dominated the collection, but Harvard had expanded its holdings in recent years to include a substantial number of useful works on agriculture, architecture, astronomy, geography, history, law, mathematics, medicine, philology, and many other subjects. Once he returned from his journey through New England, Washington resumed the business of governing the nation. Earlier that year, he had emphasized to Congress the importance of creating a national militia, but so far the issue remained unsettled. Washington, who felt that the unresolved situation threatened national security, hoped to accelerate its creation. Once more he turned to books for help. The third week of December, 1789, he read Baron von Steuben's letter on the subject of an established militia, as well as a recent government document on the same subject, a plan for the general arrangement of the militia of the United States. After digesting both works, Washington spoke with Henry Knox, who agreed to prepare a report on the subject for Congress. Knox would write his report the following month, but it would take Congress two more years to pass an act providing for a national militia. In December, Washington also read Antoine Simon Lepage Duprat's History of Louisiana, which may represent the closest he came to pleasure reading in his first year as president. Yet Lepage's personal history was not solely pleasure reading. Louisiana, a Spanish territory at the time, was becoming increasingly important to the settling of North America, as the extensive notes Washington took from Lepage's work indicate. His surviving manuscript notes fill 12 closely written pages and indicate Washington's desire to assimilate the essential facts about the region. Having come to Louisiana in 1718 and stayed for 16 years, Lepage published an account of his experience in French in 1758 with an English translation 5 years later. Though more anecdotal than scientific, the book remains a pioneering work in the history of New Orleans and the Louisiana Territory. As James Madison recognized, Lepage's information on the flora and fauna broadened the contemporary understanding of the region. Lepage provided much original information regarding the lives and customs of the Natchez Indians as well. Furthermore, the detailed account of the land and its economic potential made the book a good guide for possible emigrants. In his review of the work, William Kenrick wrote that Lepage's History of Louisiana contains many things that may be of use to those who shall hereafter visit or settle in those countries. Along with its useful information, LaPage's account also included moments of pure delight. The most charming personality to emerge from his story is the unnamed native he found to cook for him, a spunky woman who could handle herself in the face of all kinds of danger. One day an alligator approached their campfire. It stopped half a dozen feet away, apparently fixated by the light of the fire. LaPage ran into his cabin to retrieve his musket. In his absence, the woman picked up a big stick and rapped the alligator on the snout, prompting it to make a hasty retreat. As LaPage returned with his gun, she just laughed, assuring him that a gun would be unnecessary to ward off the alligator. Viewed against his other literary activities as president, Washington's attention to LaPage's History of Louisiana in late 1789 is somewhat unusual. During his first year or so in office, his attention to the world of books largely involved the patronage of current American authors, historians, playwrights, poets, travel writers. His support usually took the form of subscriptions for forthcoming works, but sometimes he supplied authors with words of encouragement. In addition, he served as a figure of inspiration. Many contemporary authors put him into their works or based fictional characters on him. In May 1790, Washington received two copies of The Contrast, the renowned comedy by the Vermont poet, playwright, and novelist Royal Tyler. After its initial performance in 1787, Tyler had assigned copyright of the play to Thomas Wignell, the foremost comedian on the American stage. Not only had Wignell originally encouraged Tyler to write the work, he had also played the part of Jonathan in its first production. Tyler's writing and Wignell's performance combined to make Jonathan one of the most beloved characters on the early American stage. The character became the prototype for a classic American stereotype, Yankee Jonathan, the naive, rough-hewn, youthful hayseed who had come to represent the nation. The character of Colonel Manley, the hero of The Contrast, was partly inspired by Washington. Making a direct comparison between himself and the commander-in-chief of the Continental Army, Manley states, "I have humbly imitated our illustrious Washington in having exposed my health and life in the service of my country without reaping any other reward than the glory of conquering in so arduous a contest." Though the statement is ironic, it nonetheless pays homage to General Washington. When Wignell decided to publish The Contrast, he approached the president for help. Washington subscribed to the work, and his name appears prominently at the top of the list of subscribers. Though Washington generally refused requests from authors who wished to dedicate their works to him, he made an exception in the case of Mercy Otis Warren. One of the finest poets and playwrights to emerge from the American Revolution, she was also the wife of James Warren, who had served as a general in the Continental Army during the Revolutionary War. Washington's personal association with her husband may explain his acceptance of Mercy Otis Warren's dedication, but Washington did not say so in his letter of acceptance, which he wrote the first week of June 1790. Instead, he explained, "Although I have ever wished to avoid being drawn into public view more than was essentially necessary for public purposes, yet on the present occasion, duly sensible of the merits of the respectable and amiable writer, I shall not hesitate to accept the intended honor." Mercy Otis Warren's book appeared later that year under the title Poems, Dramatic and Miscellaneous. It consisted of two verse tragedies, The Sack of Rome and The Ladies of Castile, and 18 poems, most written during the Revolutionary War. Besides being the subject of Warren's effusive dedicatory epistle, Washington received brief mention in two of the poems. In To Honoria, on her journey to Dover, 1777, for example, the speaker of the poem looks forward to the end of the war. when Washington, conspicuous o'er the rest, by heroes, patriots, and by foes caressed, may quit the field and court the rural scene. The lines lack originality. Warren borrowed her language from Dryden's Virgil, but Washington appreciated them nonetheless. Once his copy arrived, he replied with a letter of thanks in which he predicted how the book would be received. He felt sure of its gracious and distinguished reception by the friends of virtue and science. The week after accepting Mercy Otis Warren's dedication, Washington received a similar request from another author. Preparing to publish the story of his travels through southeastern North America in search of botanical specimens, William Bartron had his friend Robert Parrish visit New York to recruit additional subscribers. He also asked Parrish to meet with President Washington and obtain permission to dedicate the book to him. Washington's friend Samuel Powell wrote a letter of introduction for Parrish, praising Bartram's character, integrity, and intellect. Bartram's bashfulness, Powell hypothesized, prevented him from approaching the president himself. Equipped with Powell's letter of introduction, Parrish obtained an audience with the president. Washington was familiar with Bartram's botanical research, having visited his Philadelphia garden during the Constitutional Convention. He was happy to subscribe to Bartram's travels, but politely refused the dedication. Washington subsequently described his meeting with Parrish to Powell, telling him that he declined the dedication not with a view to discourage a work of this kind, which I am persuaded, if executed by an able hand, may be very useful among us, but to avoid, with propriety, future applications of this nature, unless where some particular circumstances might induce a compliance. Though refusing the dedication, Washington would become friends with Bartram. After the U.S. government relocated its capital from New York to Philadelphia, Washington would patronize Bartram's garden, ordering many plant specimens from him, which he would cultivate at Mount Vernon. Around the same time Washington subscribed to Bartram's masterwork, he received a request to subscribe to another book of travels, written by an obscure author who had recently come to New York from Massachusetts, Bartholomew Burgess. Royal Tyler, Mercy Otis Warren, and William Bartram are all major figures in the field of early American literature and have received considerable attention from literary historians. Bartholomew Burgess, on the other hand, is a shadowy figure, someone who dwelt on the fringes of early American society during his lifetime and who has ever since been in danger of slipping through a rent in the fabric of history. Having decided to publish a book of travels based on his experiences in India, Burgess began soliciting subscribers for a series of Indostan letters. The list of subscribers reveals Burgess's boldness. He did not hesitate to approach leading figures in the nation. President Washington heads the list, followed by Vice President Adams. Other subscribers who lived in New York included Alexander Hamilton, Chief Justice John Jay, and Samuel Johnson, the president of Columbia University. Readers were impressed by Burgess's capacity to elicit subscriptions. One reviewer of Indostan letters commented, "Let not authors complain that literary merit does not meet with encouragement in America. Bartholomew Burgess has published a list of nearly 1,000 subscribers." Burgess's name does not appear in Washington's correspondence, so it is unknown precisely how the president obtained his subscription copy of Indostan Letters. The work complemented many other books of faraway travel in Washington's library. Burgess offers the kind of travel writing Washington had enjoyed since boyhood. He describes the customs, dress, folkways, and traditions in India. He also brings alive the street life. Acrobats and actors, fakirs and falconers, mimes and musicians, puppeteers and snake charmers. A grand spectator sport native to India pitted one ornately decorated elephant against another. Burgess found the Battle of the Elephants more engrossing than a Spanish bullfight. Indostan Letters also contained some practical suggestions. Knowledge of the culture, Burgess suggested, would help American merchants better understand how to do business in India. He argued that merchants from the United States should trade directly with India, providing a list of commodities suitable for American trade and discussing where to market which goods. He also included a glossary that would help American merchants understand key terms useful for commerce with India. The month before Burgess published Indostan Letters, George Washington received a letter from Jeremy Belknap, who had resumed his History of New Hampshire after an extended hiatus. Having learned that Washington had written to some Vermonters regarding a controversy with their neighboring state, Belknap hoped the president would supply him with copies, or at least abstracts, of them. Upon receiving Belknap's request, Washington asked Tobias Lear to look into the matter. Once Lear clarified the situation for him, Belknap could explain in his history how Washington had helped settle the boundary and smooth out the controversy between Vermont, New York, and New Hampshire. Belknap finished his second volume of The History of New Hampshire by the end of 1790 and had the third and final volume close enough to completion that he could start soliciting subscribers. Washington subscribed for the three-volume set, expressing his pleasure with Belknap for finally bringing the work to completion. When the United States relocated its national capital in November 1790, George and Martha Washington reestablished the presidential residence in Philadelphia, leasing the home of wealthy financier Robert Morris as the new presidential mansion. The evidence suggests that President Washington used what little spare time he had to immerse himself in Philadelphia's rich literary culture. Among his surviving books is an autographed copy of A Catalogue of the Books Belonging to the Library Company of Philadelphia. In January 1791, the Library Company extended borrowing privileges to the president. Washington continued to support American writers during his time in Philadelphia, including Jeremy Belknap, who took a break from nonfiction to write The Foresters, a satirical allegory of events leading to the founding of the United States, which he published anonymously in 1792. A revised and expanded edition appeared in 1796. Though Washington read few novels, he did add a copy of The Foresters to his library. Since his copy does not survive, it is unknown whether it was the first or second edition. The work is not mentioned in his correspondence with Jeremy Belknap, who kept his authorship of The Foresters a closely guarded secret. The first reference to Washington in The Foresters concerns his 1753 wilderness trek to present Governor Dinwiddie's message to the French commandant, an indication that the story of Washington's mission was already well established as part of his contemporary reputation. In this allegorical novel, the forest represents the United States, and the foresters are the American people. Belknap personified the states and assigned each one an allegorical name. Virginia, for example, is Walter Pipeweed, a name that reveals how closely Virginia was identified with Sir Walter Raleigh and tobacco culture. His grandson, George Pipeweed, represents George Washington. At one point in the story, Walter Pipeweed sends his grandson, a smart, active, lively youth, across the hills with his compliments to the intruders, desiring them to move off and threatening them with a writ in case of noncompliance. When Belknap revised and republished The Foresters in 1796, he brought the story up to date, incorporating several events from Washington's presidency. He especially emphasized the machinations of Edmond Genet, the French minister to the United States, who sought to recruit Americans to fight against the British. Throughout his dealings with Taineg, to use Belknap's unimaginative name for Genet, George Pipeweed displays his sense of purpose, his strength of conviction, and his decisive action. Before he revised and republished The Foresters, Belknap began a new multi-volume historical work, which would present a series of biographical essays of famous Americans. The first appeared in 1794 as American Biography, or An Historical Account of Those Persons Who Have Been Distinguished in America as Adventurers, Statesmen, Philosophers, Divines, Warriors, Authors, and Other Remarkable Characters. Belknap published this work by subscription, but presented a copy of the first volume to President Washington, who then subscribed for the second. Washington would subscribe for a total of 4 sets. After Washington left office, Belknap stayed in contact with him, providing progress reports and asking for additional help. The last week of May, 1798, Belknap thanked him for his kind words about the first volume of American Biography and informed him that the second had gone to press and would soon be published. In the meantime, Belknap sent him a copy of a fast day sermon he had delivered earlier that month. Belknap projected several additional volumes of American Biography and asked for Washington's help with some particulars, concluding, "You will excuse, sir, my importunity, when you consider the necessity of my having the best information and the most original and authentic materials. I never content myself with the streams when the fountain is accessible." Washington replied, writing 1 letter in June and a follow-up letter the next month. He promised to ask Samuel Chase, an associate justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, for his help. Washington also agreed to solicit subscribers from Virginia for American Biography. His offer for help did not stop there. Washington continued, "If I can render you any service in procuring materials for your valuable biography, I shall feel pleasure in doing it. I hope both life and health will be dispensed to you by him in whose hands all things are, until this and many others of your good works are completed." Sadly, Washington's best wishes for his life and health were in vain. The Reverend Jeremy Belknap passed away before either of Washington's letters reached him. His son Andrew informed Washington of the melancholy news, but assured him that the second volume of American Biography was in press and would be published soon. With his letter, Andrew Belknap sent another volume for Washington's library at Mount Vernon, a funeral sermon commemorating his father. Before learning of Belknap's death, Washington did what he had promised. He wrote Justice Chase, asking him to help locate the information Belknap needed. His letter emphasizes the importance of encouraging such literary efforts. "As Mr. Belknap is a man of character and abilities, writes well, and seems anxious to be correct in what he gives to the public, he merits encouragement and aid from those who have it in their power to afford it." What Washington says about Belknap applies to the other American writers he admired. Throughout both his presidency and his retirement, George Washington recognized many American authors with character and ability. He worked hard to facilitate their literary pursuit.